Hello, my friends. Welcome to Let's Talk. My name is Shay Marville, and I think one of the most important skills in this world is being able to have a conversation with a friend or a foe. Let's Talk is a podcast about listening, growing, connecting, and hoping through compassion and talking. And I mean really talking about the good things and the hard things, and with remarkable people living in a remarkable time. So let's talk. Hello, my friends. Welcome to Let's Talk. On today's episode, I have the great honor of sharing a conversation I had about 4 weeks ago with Dr. Natisha Massaquoi. She has been an advocate for the advancement of Black women's healthcare in Canada for 30 years. She holds a PhD in social justice education from the University of Toronto. In her early career, she established several organizations, including Africans in Partnerships Against AIDS and the Harambee Family Service Center. And she served for 20 years as the executive director of Women's Health in Women's Hands Community Healthcare Center in Toronto. It happens to be the only community health center in North America which provides specialized primary health care for Black and racialized women. Dr. Massaquoi, Natisha, welcome to Let's Talk. So let's talk. I'm so excited to have you here. Because of this pandemic and all the work that you've done over the last, 30 years, but 20 years around women's health and Black women's health, and that community is really impacted by the last 16 months. So I was excited to talk to you about that piece. I want to know how you're doing. I want to know what your PhD means now. You just got your PhD. I mean, I don't even know if we have enough time. So let's just get started and see. How are you?
Well, I probably, like everyone else, where I'm exhausted as we come on what I hope is the tail end of this pandemic. And so it's been an interesting time. I'm privileged. I'm well. I'm healthy. I'm housed. I'm, employed, all those things. But I'm just very, very, very tired. And very grateful that I got my first shot.
Yes.
Which we know I've spent a lot of time studying epidemics, interesting enough, and the impact of epidemics on Black communities. And so to be in the midst of one while you're doing the work of researching in pandemics has been very, very challenging. But, I think we're going to be different after this pandemic. And
yes,
we're going to be better.
Better? What do you mean?
My work is literally looking at increasing access to health services for Black women. And I've done that for a long time. And, 30 years ago when I started doing this work and talking about it so boldly, which would have been seen very bold and unconventional at the time, it was seen as some kind of radical thing.
Yes, it was.
Radical. She's radical. And now it's like, we have to talk about this. Oh my gosh, right? There was this awakening. And I mean, we have to be grateful to Mr. George Floyd for opening that space up in terms
yes.
of the world now understanding the impact of anti-Black racism. And so in my corner of the world, it really was significant because it happened during a pandemic.
Right. And I think now it's more common to hear the term the social determinants of health. Like that's not some wild concept that doesn't mean anything. Now, everyone that's involved in the healthcare system and also in the educational and the political system understand that you cannot talk about groups of people without talking about their healthcare and without talking about what the social determinants of their health is. Why do you think we are going to be better?
When I say better, the system is going, it can't ignore us anymore. That's the bottom line. Nor are we going to allow the system to ignore us anymore. And it's, I'm not going to say that Black people have not been shouting about healthcare needs and racism in healthcare and all those experiences that we've had. What's better is the fact that it can't be ignored anymore. The data is there, the evidence is there, and the allies are there, which I could say when I started in this business, allyship wasn't even a word. It wasn't even something that we talked about. But now people who are not Black are even some of the biggest advocates.
Yes. Yeah.
Because we can't ignore this anymore.
How did you find yourself in this work? Like what, you know, when it was considered radical, why were you radical? What radicalized you into women's health and in particular Black women's health?
You know, it's a couple of things. So both of my parents were healthcare providers and came to Canada, were recruited during a phase in Canadian history, which a lot of people don't know about. And I think you may have been impacted by this, where Canada was recruiting from England.
Yes.
And they were specifically recruiting Black nurses, Black physicians, Black healthcare providers because of the shortage of providers that we had in Canada.
What year was that?
So that started taking place in the 60s, 50s into the 60s.
Yes.
50s into the 60s. And so you'll see a lot of Black women coming to Canada during that period.
Yeah.
As nurses.
Like my mom.
I assume she came from England. And yes, there was a belief that these women and men as well, my father was a physician who was recruited, had already been exposed to the West. They had already been exposed to Western science and healthcare systems. So it's an easy group of people to integrate into Canada very quickly.
Right.
So, you know, my home life was very much about healthcare. So that's one thing. But, you know, when I went to university very young, so it's a 17-year-old, I went to the University of Western Ontario. And I was in Dr. Philip Rushton's class.
Really? Oh, my goodness. What was that like?
A soul blow. I didn't last very long because the...
No.
What we didn't know at the time was that he was teaching eugenics. What I did know is how I felt in the class, that I felt scared to be in his class, that what he was proposing about Black people, our brain size determined our lack of intellect. And I mean, I can go on and on if you understand eugenics.
Insane. It's insane that he was even in that position, much less that he thought those things.
Absolutely.
But I've actually never met anyone who was in his class.
So that sparked, I mean, a level of protest from us as students that isn't captured. We didn't have social media back then. It's not well documented, the level of resistance and protest. And that sparks the under no circumstances will we accept that kind of thought process. So, you know, when I started pursuing my career in healthcare, that experience always sat with me. It always sat with me. You know, just to speed up sort of the trajectory, I had an opportunity, again, also as a young person, to develop a health center for Black and racialized women, which we again had to fight for. We staged a sit-in at the Minister of Health's office just to say that in Canada, we have no specialized services for Black and racialized women. We're asking for one space.
Yes.
To be funded. And you know, we fought for that. And so, you know, 21 years of my career was spent developing, designing, leading specialized health services for women. The fight again is watching Black women in particular come for health services late, very late. when illness already had taken place, when the diabetes was already present, when the cancer was already present, and nobody being able to explain why our prevalence rates were so high. No researchers, there were no studies being done, nothing being written.
Why do you think that was? Like, why or is? Why do you think Black women are treated differently by the healthcare system? I know it's changing, but that doesn't negate what has occurred.
It's understanding how the Canadian system is developed. It literally is based on, if you go back to our arrival in Canada, we're the first racialized group to arrive in Canada as enslaved African people.
Yes.
So we've been here as long as the British and French. Mm. But the constant negating of our history is the negating of people. So
right.
Our systems are set up to not see us, to not recognize us, to not prioritize us.
Yes.
So the healthcare system is no different than any other system in Canada. And so we're not prioritized in any kind of way. The rule of thumb in healthcare is that the populations with the highest need should get the most services, should get the most priority.
Mm-hmm.
If you can address the populations with the highest need, then everyone else will be served.
Right.
Our system, because it's a universal healthcare system, free healthcare, does not function in that way. Right? Because then we have to share resources.
Yes, yes.
You have to share taxpayers' money. And if you have a society that absolutely does not prioritize Black people, doesn't see them as valuable, doesn't see them as contributing, I'm not going to allow my taxpayer money to go to prioritize Black women.
Hmm.
So and
that's even though so many Black women have been contributing economically, have been healthcare providers and caregivers for decades and decades, you know, for centuries.
Centuries.
And so even with that, they're invisible. I wonder also, what is the role of culture, of the different diverse Black cultures, and communicating about what their needs are in terms of healthcare?
Interesting enough, so Canada has the most diverse Black population outside of Africa. So we hold that distinction. Right? We come from about 166 countries. So you can imagine how many languages and cultural practices are involved in just who we are in Canada.
Fascinating.
So you know, yes, we do have to take that into consideration. And we have to think about all the spaces that we come from. So continental African, from the Caribbean, we always forget Latin America. We have to think about, you know, we have to really think about, you know, those of us that have come via Europe, and we go on and on. So understanding the diversity within our community as Black people is number one. Two, you don't learn about this in school.
No. So
absence of any Black history or understanding is out of the school system.
Mm.
Right. So you never learn about who we are. And we rely heavily on American stereotypes and television and media to fill in the blanks. Right. So
see, that's interesting. Let's stick with that for just a second. Because this is a general issue for Canadians, for all Canadians, that we are subsumed by American culture. They are unaware of it. and then within that, the story of Blackness is often the African-American story, which is also a diverse story that doesn't always get told. But but we don't even exist in their story.
That's right. And so you need to understand that, you know, the default to go to the African-American story means, A, we become invisible again, because that is not our story. That is,
no.
It is a part of our story, but it is not a large percentage of our story. And it also doesn't allow you to talk about African Canadians who have been here six, seven, eight generations. You know, or it doesn't tell your mother's story, right? It doesn't tell the story of your family. It doesn't tell the story of my family.
No.
You know, we're allowed very narrow versions of ourselves. And so when I say post-COVID things will be better, we are going to look at ourselves differently and we're going to demand to be represented differently. And that's what the better part is for me.
Oh, I think that's a powerful way to analyze what we are going forward to, and also hopeful, because I think a lot of people are struggling with, you know, whether they can be hopeful. And because so much of our culture as Black women is seen through an American lens, I think it's easy to get taken in or pulled in to a story that doesn't really belong to you. And then we're trying to search for, like, where do we belong? What's our story? How do I share that story and bring it forward? That's why so much of the work, like, I mean, all of the work that you're doing is so essential, because I just feel like you're creating space.
We have to create space. We have so few spaces as Black women in Canadian society. You know, I often talk about we have limited spaces to escape from the racism that we experience, which is an interesting thing because you're dealing with it daily. You're dealing with it at work. You're dealing with it at school. You know, you have your home, and hopefully that is a safe space. For some women, it is not a safe space. So, you know, we'll be realistic about that as well. But we have so few institutions that are designed specifically for us. And anything that we have, we had to fight to create it.
So, and when you say designed, like someone else might say, well, what space is designed for any group of people in particular? How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I work in healthcare. I work in healthcare predominantly. So, you know, I can go into a hospital, let's say, and the CEO is white. The senior VP levels are white.
Yeah.
Board is white. Actually, everybody in any position of power is white. And that is not an uncommon scenario, right? In fact, I can go into most major Canadian institutions and it will look like that. And when I ask them, so where are Black people situated in your institution? It will be in the lowest levels of the organization. And not to say that all work is not important, but, you know, in the hierarchy of life.
Yes.
Right. So we will show up in environmental services, in housekeeping, in food services, you know, in a hospital setting. If we're nurses, we're not the managers, right? We're the frontline nurses. And then you'll ask, okay, what's the highest level a Black person has reached? And, you know, you may see a manager. You may. One or two. That is a common scenario in almost all of our Canadian institutions. If you walk into one right now.
Yes.
When I say space is not designed for us, spaces that are designed for us are spaces that allow us to flourish, that allow us to lead, that allow us to go anywhere in that organization that we want to achieve, or any space we want to occupy. And right now, those spaces are very few and far between. So that's an organization that is not designed for us because it doesn't allow me to be my best self.
Doesn't allow you to be your best self. And do you think that idea is true for corporate Canada as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Even more so. It's entrenched.
It's entrenched.
In corporate Canada.
So when you're talking to and working with young women, young women from the diverse diaspora, how do you encourage them to find a place and take their place?
Absolutely. Number one, once you decide what it is that you want to do, if someone tells you no, you're talking to the wrong person. You have to find another person, right? So do not accept no.
Yes.
Because oftentimes you're going to hear a lot of no's. If I think about my own schooling, right, the amount of no's, right?
I'm putting both hands up. Right? I'm putting both
no,
hands up.
No, you can't go to university. No, you know, no. You want to go to graduate school? No.
Yeah. No, no. Like, I mean, it's not a good formula for self-esteem.
No. Right. So first of all, we have to live with the reality of A, as a Black woman, this is what you're going to hear a lot. So I need to train you to not accept it, right? Not internalize it. That before we even start talking about what you're going to do, let's work on that piece. Because no one told me I was going to hear a lot of no's or, you know, right?
So no, fact, what you're told is work hard.
That's right.
Work harder. And as long as you work hard, you're going to keep progressing, right?
Right?
But no one says, and even though they might say there's racism, no one says you can work hard and present really, you know, well and still not succeed.
That's right.
Right? Over and over again, over and over again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you will experience this for your entire career. So don't get comfortable. Right. You may achieve whatever level, but every time you're going to go to the next level, don't be surprised. You know, and it has nothing to do with what your hair looks like. It has nothing to do with, you know, I used to have dreadlocks and that used to be if you have dreadlocks, you will not succeed. I'm like, no, it has nothing to do with my hair.
No,
nothing to do with my hair.
I know. In fact, I can't stand the whole hair thing over and over again. I blame Chris Rock for this.
Good hair.
Because of that movie, that documentary so many years ago, from that moment, I feel like it just opened the gates of, you know, can I touch your hair? Is your hair real? Are those extensions? Are you wearing a unit? Why don't you dread? You should dread. Like, I mean, it's on and on and on. And who cares?
I know. Absolutely. So, you know, as a young person, obviously internalize all this stuff, right? So
the nonsense
appearance is very important to you as a teenager, especially.
Yes, right? Yes, totally.
So, you know, let's unlink that. You can look however you want. I have no judgment. Let's unlink it from this is what's going to create success for you. Linking people with mentors, and I, you know, mentorship is a touchy subject, you know, but anyway.
Why do you say that? Why do you say it's a touchy subject? I'm really curious to hear what you have to say about this.
Well, sometimes it's seen as this quick fix. Like if I just have a mentor,
yes,
you know, doors are going to open for me.
Right.
And, you know, someone corrected me recently and they said, it's not a mentor. It's a promoter. It's someone who has access to spaces. And when they go into those spaces, they will promote you. They will talk about you. They will push you forward. They will be handing out your CV. They, you know, so it's a promoter. It's like a manager almost.
Yes, right? Yes.
Your PR, your hype person. Because, you know, I could mentor somebody, but I myself have no access to the spaces that they need to be in.
And precisely.
So, yeah, we need to get our young people into those spaces early. This is the other thing that I've found really challenging is that oftentimes our mentorship might happen at, you know, university. And this is when we start learning about different fields or different spaces we want to be in. But we didn't know about it when we were in high school or even earlier because we weren't necessarily surrounded by it. I mean,
our
community is smaller. B, we haven't had a lot of access to unconventional, untraditional types of work. And, you know, that's systemic. That is systemic. Mm. But if I look at who approaches me from like high school, you know, young people from other races in particular,
yes.
Right? Their
yes.
family are like, hey, you know, can you speak to my niece? She's very interested in what you do.
Yeah.
You know, they're booking the appointment. They have the language to even approach you. They have the confidence.
Yes.
And I find sometimes with young Black people, because we haven't had that exposure, I have to go out and find them.
I see. So do you not think that is also related to your parents and the community that you live in, like what you are exposed to, what you're seeing? So you don't know that you can ask.
Absolutely.
and that asking is not a weakness, that asking is just part of learning to succeed.
Absolutely. And it's not that culturally, as Black, you know, as diverse as we are not here to succeed. None of us have come to this country to not succeed. Right? Like, it doesn't make sense. It is not our goal to not succeed. We are all here to succeed.
Yes.
It's just the way that we engage in success looks different than Canadian dominant culture, and dominant culture of white privilege in particular.
Yes.
And so, you know, once you learn that mechanism, once you can turn that key, then you'll see doors open. The bigger issue that we're going to deal with now post-COVID is leadership. Who's in leadership and who has decision-making power?
Who is in power and who is making decisions? Can you unpack that a little bit? Because I think even the word or the term white privilege is bandied about in all sorts of ways. As soon as some people hear it, they're offended, or they feel disconnected because they feel like, I don't represent that. I'm not part of that. So talk to me about that a bit.
You know, an interesting part of my work, I do a lot of coaching with senior executives, usually CEOs. And they're all white. You know, we'll be very realistic. In my business, they are all white in the city of Toronto.
Because you're working with decision makers.
Yeah, and it's in its health. It's the healthcare system. So that is who's there. So, you know, one of the things that we talk about in terms of, you know, because white privilege is a very interesting topic, and it's not one that I particularly coach on, but everyone's been reading Robin DiAngelo's work.
Yes.
So they often like bring it, right? You know, like, okay, maybe I better read this book.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, my very basic concept that I want you to understand in terms of white privilege is the understanding that you have had challenges in your life. I'm sure you have. But your inability to succeed isn't because of your race. It might be other things. It might be your gender, right? It might be your sexual orientation. It might be, but it's not because of your race. Right. Yeah. And in fact, that has afforded you privilege. It's afforded you access in a way that someone who is not white has not had. And in healthcare, it's very plain and obvious. It's very obvious. Something as simple as in Toronto, you can go into any major hospital. The ratio of Black physicians to white physicians reads like 5 to 1,200, right? 6 to 900, you know, and these are very specific hospitals that I'm talking about. So yes, they're very in your face in healthcare. So, you know, the question I have is, now that you understand that you have privilege, what are you going to do with it? Right? It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing unless you use it badly.
Right. And everyone has privilege to a certain degree. Everyone has privilege, but it's what the privilege is worth. That's right. The society in which you are living.
That's right. And how are you going to use it? How are you going to use it to change, to make change? You know, so a lot of the senior leadership in hospitals now are working on increasing diversity. And I'm like, that's great. What is your succession plan to replace yourself with someone who is not white?
Oh, that's a powerful question.
Yeah, let's work through that one.
Wow.
Let's work through that one, right? Because the reason why for the last 150 years of this particular institution, every senior leader has been white. So is it part of your legacy that you'll disrupt that? Or put the mechanisms in place? Because we always think about diversifying everything underneath us.
Yes.
Right. We don't think about diversifying everything above us.
Right. But I wonder about that, because I wonder about just the trajectory of a person's career and the way we are trained as professionals to compete, achieve, to be ambitious, to pursue leadership positions, you're not thinking about who replaces me as a leader. I mean, in succession planning, yes, you're mentoring, right? But I have met many mentors at VP levels who never become the CEO.
Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine. But how are you being replaced by someone who does not look like you?
Yeah.
Who does not share the same background as you, doesn't share the same history as you?
That's a huge, kind of a earthquake type of question, because I just think that when people are thinking about their succession planning, they're probably not thinking about race and gender and language and ability and whether someone is Black or not, right?
They're not thinking about it consciously. They are thinking about it unconsciously. They are thinking about it because that's why everyone, they're replicating themselves continuously.
Yes.
So you're thinking about it. The same energy that you're using to maintain uniformity at that level,
mm-hmm.
let's flip it. Use that same energy to increase diversity at that level.
Right.
Right? Because you are, it's work.
Yes, it's work.
The city of Toronto is 51% racialized. So you can't have a space where 99.9%, right? You're overrepresented.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
We focus on a lot of times in EDI, in equity, diversity, inclusion, where we focus on underrepresentation.
Yes.
Right. We always focus. I'm like, no, I'm interested in overrepresentation.
Oh, so, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah. So 51% of the city is racialized. How on earth did you create a senior leadership team that's 100% white? You're overrepresenting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that is unconscious blindness, right? Or and racism and all the different types of isms. But is it not also the fact that people hire people that just are in their network and who look like themselves? And so they just have no, they don't know anyone outside of their network.
Right. So to keep that network undiverse takes work.
Yes. Yeah.
It takes work. So you're actively excluding people continuously. And you've all decided to do it. Conscious or unconscious.
But silently you've decided to do it because you've said, this is where I feel the most comfortable.
Right. And that's how white privilege works. It's the silence, because you never have to talk about it. You never have to name it. It's totally okay to say, yes, we are going to take 100% of all seats. And no one's going to question that. It's totally fine. And then you'll say things like, but we chose the best qualified. But the favorite one I get now is, well, you know, we recruit all of our senior executives from X school, from this particular school, or from this school, or whatever. And so it's the school's fault. The school is not, right? The school is not diverse, right? If there were diverse candidates, I would have chosen them, right? So, you know, we're hearing all of the rationale now coming forward in terms of how you maintain spaces or exclude people from spaces. But I do have to say in my work now, what people are calling me to address is not just lack of diversity, racial diversity, it's the lack of Black people specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is with Black and Indigenous people in particular, you will see us completely absent from spaces. And that has a lot to do with a long history, 400 years.
Yes, of course.
And there's a reason why Black and Indigenous are very absent from spaces compared to other groups of people. And it's how we've been conceptualized from the beginning of our time in Canada.
Absolutely. And how that concept and the invisible nature of our history, how that has evolved, so that we don't, so it's hard to exclude something you cannot see. It's hard to include something you cannot see.
That's right.
Right. And to notice.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been an interesting year, where probably the first time in my career, my allies, you know, white colleagues have been very forthcoming with the internal thoughts that have always been sitting there. So the reasons why they believe Black people are not present in their spaces. And it all has to do with us, right? That we aren't ready. We aren't qualified. There just aren't enough of you. I'm like, but you're talking to me. You're talking to me.
So what do you suggest we do as one, as a society, as a Canadian society, to address this? And two, as individuals, what because this is, I mean, for many people of Black descent, this last 16 months has been very painful.
Very painful.
I mean, conversations that you don't want to have, actually. Like, some people are like, I mean, listen, my first degree is in anti-racism. I got out of the anti-racism, you know, and that I'm old. So that degree is old. that I got out of anti-racism a long time ago because it's so challenging when it's invisible.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, at the time when you would have been doing that, people weren't willing to have conversations. Right? Yeah. We were fighting with people to have conversations.
Yes.
You know, the big thing right now, if we, you know, the last week in Canada has just been horrific. It's been absolutely horrific with the discovery of the 215 Indigenous children in a mass grave.
Chills.
The Canadian situation is one where, you know what, we just all have to individually commit to no longer ignoring our history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have to sit with it, that we belong to a society that allowed, not even just allowed it to happen, sanctioned, instituted, mandated it to happen.
Yeah. And even now in the revelation of these 215 human children, their bodies being found, what is the plan for the inquiry I am so tired personally of hearing this doesn't happen in Canada. This isn't us. And we want to honor their lives and apologize. How can that be satisfying to any one of us who calls ourselves Canadian?
That's right. And so, you know, any of the work, I always start my work off by saying my focus, yes, is on Black community and Black community survival, our health and well-being, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that at the expense of Indigenous people, or we'll move nowhere. So number one, we all have to educate ourselves, all of us. That's our individual work. And figure out what each of us need to do to at least honor the history of Indigenous people, understand what anti-Indigeneity is, understand what anti-colonial practices look like, and then in my personal space, what is it that I have to do or what I can do? Because until I understand that, there's no way we can move to other forms of racism and discrimination. They all come from and start from that place of anti-Indigeneity in Canada. So if I can close my eyes to mass graves of children, then I can close my eyes to all other forms of suffering that people are experiencing. So we have to get comfortable. It's going to be a rough year and years to come.
I think there's years and years of work to be done. And I think I'd like to know what you think about this. I mean, I was joking about not doing anti-racism work. I don't do it the same way. It's all related to what I do. And I believe that, you know, wellness and healing are an important part of having hard conversations.
That's right.
What are you doing within the community to inspire healing? And what do you do as an individual who's doing this work of advocacy to help heal yourself?
That's right. Now, I would challenge you to say, yes, you are doing anti-racism work.
Always.
You are absolutely doing anti-racism work. Because any work that is encouraging people to be in touch with who they are, right, to do healing work, to rest, that is anti-racism work. That is revolutionary work. Because our society tells us to do something else. It tells us to do something else. And people, regardless of your race, when you are in touch with and you are well, you actually can sit down and do this anti-racism work.
Completely.
You have the capacity to have empathy towards other people.
And to listen. Mm-hmm. You can listen. You know, when you're in pain and you're suffering yourself, you cannot bear to hear more pain.
That's right. And so, you know, a lot of the work that I've been doing, especially in Black community, has been telling people to rest. Because our tendency is, especially after George Floyd's murder, is to jump up, right? And to go into combat mode.
Yes.
And what I've been asking people to really sit down and think about is trauma. That we've experienced years of accumulated trauma that we have not had time to address, that we have not had time to heal, right? That we don't have coping mechanisms to deal with. When we're not doing that, what I get to see is the other end of it, which is high rates of heart disease, high rates of hypertension, high rates of diabetes, all of the stress-related illnesses, right? Not the time to do just basic screening. So we have high cancer rates with all cancers, cervical, breast. I mean, our health outcomes are so poor. And this is literally based on our experience of anti-racism. And a healthcare system that is not responsive to our needs, as well as a society that doesn't understand what anti-Black racism means in terms of trauma, daily trauma.
Yes.
And so, you know, let's now become very aware of the messages even that we've gotten as young people, and especially as Black women. Get up, turn the other cheek. You're better than that. You're, you know. Let's take the high road. I mean, I could think of all of the messages, right? Don't take your personal business out in the street. Don't go and talk to anybody about it. You know, all of those messages, which are about survival.
Yes, yes.
But they're not doing us well right now, especially as adult Black women who've had a lifetime.
Yes, yes. Lifetime
experiences. And so I really appreciate your work. I know in our health center, we incorporated meditation, mindfulness, yoga practices, because, and for free, because I had no excuses.
No excuses.
For people to say, I don't have time. It's like, oh, really? Look, your doctor's appointment is here and you can catch the yoga class that's going to start in about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, creating those spaces of wellness and healing and honoring ourselves as individuals, because we're in a society which is not honoring us,
right,
care of us,
and it's also a society that doesn't honor the value of health for anyone, really. So and it's a society where it's based on a Western idea of, you know, sort of denial about certain things. So it's you. So that is the framework to begin with, and then within that, trying to talk about the things that are the hardest can be most challenging.
Absolutely.
Now I know you are busy writing and coaching and teaching, and then you've got this incredible daughter that you're raising in the midst of this ongoing pandemic, ongoing lockdown. Of Ontario. I have a question that's not very serious. Just want to know your opinion, if you've thought about it. The comedian Monique, I don't know if you heard about this, she did an Instagram share about all these young Black women at the airport wearing their bonnets and their slippers and their blankets. And it caused an uproar because people just, some people hated her for saying it. Some people were like, thank God you said it. Any thoughts?
I'm afraid to say it. I saw it and I'm like, oh my God, I have reached that age.
Oh God. Like,
please don't put on the bonnet. Please don't wear the bonnet. You know,
I just think it's different values.
I know.
I think it's different values. I don't like just what you said about all these phrases that have been told to Black women all of their lives. They're like these literary prisons, right? And about how to behave and how to present yourself and how to look out in public. There's a whole generation of people who do not care about that anymore.
Absolutely.
And they're walking around going, my bonnet has nothing to do with my dignity. If that's your opinion, then go for it. Doesn't change my opinion of myself. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not unhappy that she said it, because I think that's what her role is, you know, to be provocative. I just thought the outcry was amusing. I mean, on TikTok, people are like going
crazy. Oh my gosh, some of the
crazy
responses are hilarious.
Hilarious.
I love them. And, you know, of course, I'm raised by that generation where—
Me too.
You have, and you know, it's interesting because one of the things that I teach is something called pristine perfection.
Oh.
Pristine perfection is a term I came up with, and it's a negative thing.
Yes.
It results in a negative thing where I was taught that everything had to be perfect. My hair had to be perfect. My clothes
yes.
had to be pressed. I had to have on a slip, like every time I left the house. Right. But the level of anxiety that causes.
Precisely.
Right. Because of the pristineness, right?
Like, yes.
Do not show up at work every single day looking pristine.
Perfect.
Something terrible is going to happen. Something
yes.
absolutely terrible is going to happen.
And you're going to deserve it.
Yeah.
Because you did not show up the way you should be showing up.
That's right. So I know as a healthcare provider, the level of stress this has caused Black women in particular.
Yeah.
We will never be perfect enough to succeed in certain spaces. So I can't turn around and say, don't wear the bonnet and don't wear slippers. Right? Because I know I'm just reinstating the thing that I'm trying to fight against, right?
Precisely. And I think the other thing is, why are we evaluating young Black women this way, and yet other women can do whatever they want to do? And then in pop culture, so much of pop culture is the style and the sound of this whole generation of, or you know, of these young women of Black descent. I mean, it is meaningless in a way, but it's also a bit fascinating.
Yeah,
you know, at the same time, it makes me think also about this idea of the imposter syndrome. Do you think that Black women struggle with the imposter syndrome the way other women do?
I think we, I shouldn't say I think we, because I don't want to speak for everybody.
Yes.
But imposter syndrome shows up more in spaces when I'm working with Black women than other groups of women. Other groups of women believe they deserve the success. They believe they deserve to be where they are. They even believe that they should be in higher spaces.
Yes, yes.
Without problem, without hesitation. I find from the time, particularly Black women get into even professional schools. So mm-hmm. in school, the imposter syndrome is already kicking in. Mm. I teach it. Even undergraduate level, just a BA creates that imposter syndrome anxiety for young Black women, especially if they're, you know, the first in their family to get
yes.
that. Now, what fuels imposter syndrome for us, and this is why I think it's we feel it harsher, is that everyone around you is agreeing with you. No, you shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be here. Oh, you really? Oh, maybe you got that through some equity initiative.
Yes.
That's why you've got that seat. That's why you're sitting here. So you're hearing all of this negative rhetoric around you. So it fuels it. It increases the belief that, yeah, maybe I shouldn't be here.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Well, I work with with clients who experience it and from a variety of backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And it's one of my ambitions is to rid us of that yeah. imposter syndrome, because it has to do with the culture, not you.
That's right. And I mean, it's just women, period. It's a gendered, very gendered yes. thing in a lot of respects. So women as a whole.
Yeah.
But then a woman who's also experiencing racism in that That's space. Right.
Yes.
Amplifies it.
The questioning. Well, you know who's not an imposter? You. You are the real, real deal. And I am so grateful that you came on the show. And I want to wish you continued success and health and wellness. And I look forward to you coming back and sharing more of your insight and your data, which you are chock full of data. So.
Oh, yeah. And I have a new job. I have a new job as of July 1st. So I will have lots of data for you.
Oh, Mike, what are you going into? Let's end on.
I have accepted an assistant professor position at U of T. So I will officially be a professor in health and society, and I have a graduate appointment with the Faculty of Social Work. So I will be very busy as of July 1st.
Congratulations. What a way to end the show. Thank you, my friend. Thank you for joining the conversation. We are growing an amazing community here at Let's Talk. Please share the show. Make sure you're subscribing and keep talking. And you can always reach out to me at CoachShayMarville.com or on Instagram at ShayMarville. Let's Talk. Let's keep talking.